I'm ready.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. I'm Clayton Pixton, and you are watching Joseph Smith, Impressions of a Prophet, with Susan Easton Black. And of course, we have with us...
Susan Easton Black, and I'm delighted to be with you again, Clayton.
It's always good to be with you. And these are a highlight of my Monday evening. More than that, a highlight of my week and everything. So, all right, guys, we're going to move on to the organization of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And I'm going to kick things off here with a hymn written by a guy who was a convert from the British Isles, I believe Ireland. He wrote the words. It was a tune that somebody else wrote and exists in other hymns. But I think his words are awesome, and I guess so. Then they're original to our church. So, Israel, Israel, God is calling, calling thee from lands of woe. Babylon the great is falling. God shall all her towers o'erthrow. Come to Zion, come to Zion. Of anger flow. Come to Zion, come to Zion, ere his floods of anger flow. There you go.
Oh,
Israel,
great.
Israel, God is calling. We'll do another verse of that at the end. And I guess, Susan, I don't have any big news or announcements, so unless you do.
As far as I know, everything is status quo. There's something nice about that, isn't it?
Yes, yes indeed. So please kick us off with the organization of the church.
Okay, today we're going to talk about the organization of the church. And this building you're seeing was built by the church 150 years after the church was organized as part of the sesquicentennial celebration. So since that time, it's been known as Peter Whitmer log home there in a place called Fayette, New York. We're going to learn some details of that organizational meeting. And as we start out, we're going to start out in March of 1830. So notice the church will be organized in April. So we're a month before, and in March towards the end of 1830, the Book of Mormon is finally off the press and ready to be sold. You could purchase a copy of it at the E.B. Grandin bookstore there in Palmyra, right on the main street. And you could purchase a copy for, I don't know, about $1.75. Today, Clayton, these books are pretty priceless. Some of the books were bound, like you see here, and some were paperback, which means they just really weren't bound. They're just the white pages sewn together. But as the book now comes off the press, many people will acquire copies. And as they acquired copies, they began to get together as believers. One group of believers met in the Smith family home. And here it's showing there in Palmyra, New York. I think one thing I find so interesting is they'd meet on a Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, but on Sunday, everybody would attend their normal church, whether it was a Presbyterian, the Baptist, the Methodist, whatever church of choice, and then they get back together as believers in the Book of Mormon. So there's no church related to the Book of Mormon that they can attend, and so they're attending their old-time religions. You've got one group then meeting at the Smith Farmhouse in Palmyra. You've got another group meeting in a place called Colesville, New York, and they're meeting at the Joseph Knight Senior Home, and it's always called the Colesville Branch, and of all the groups of believers, this had the most people. About 60 would actually gather somewhere around the home and talk about the Book of Mormon, and then, like in Palmyra, attend their other churches. You also have a group that was meeting then around the Peter Whitmer farmhouse. And so you'd say, you've got all these believers, they've got various churches, and now the question is, where do we go from here? And if you look now, you'll see that inside of the Peter Whitmer farm, here's the room that the church now has restored to show where the organizational meeting took place. And it's meeting on April 6, 1830, as asked by the Lord. So April 6, 1830 becomes our very important date. And on this date, as Joseph now meets with believers, we don't know exactly how many are present. Some will say from 50 to 60, that's David Whitmer. But we know that there will be six official members of the church, and they're men. And obviously Joseph's one, Oliver's one, and
they had been baptized previous to April 6th.
Right. And yes, there had been baptisms previous. And notice they're baptized because they believe in the Book of Mormon. But at this point, now they've got a church to attend. Now, as they met there, the question is, well, what's going to be the name of this church? And we're going to find that the name of the church in 1830, as they have this foundation meeting then at the Whitmer home, it was called the Church of Christ, and it will be called that from 1830 to 1834. So missionaries, they go out with the Book of Mormon, they say they're representing the Church of Christ. In 1834, you get, even in some church publications, it's called the Church of the Latter-day Saints. And notice you're missing the name of Christ in the second name. And the belief was is that the word saints means followers of Christ, and so to include his name would be redundant. And then you get the Church of Christ of Latter-day Saints from 1836 to 38.
Pretty close, right?
But the Lord goes, hey, you haven't quite got it right yet. So it's not until April 26 of 1838 that you get the name that we now call the church, and it comes by revelation of the Lord while the prophet's out there in far west Missouri. So the name of the church then, finally, 8 years after that foundational meeting in the Peter Whitmer farmhouse, is called the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Now, we're going to find at that foundational meeting and subsequent meetings after that, there's actually a constitution of the church. And many churches have like bylaws, constitutions, and it's basically an outline of the principles and doctrines that the church stands by. So notice ours is located in Doctrine and Covenants, section 20. And in that section, you can learn what the church stands for, what we believe, and responsibilities of those that hold various offices, especially in the priesthood. So in section 20, hopefully there are a lot of our readers are interested in that constitution, and they'll open up the Doctrine and Covenants, and they'll learn about the creation, the fall of Adam and Eve, the atonement of Jesus Christ, why it's necessary to be baptized, even though you could say, well, I've been baptized into a different church. It's necessary to be baptized by authority. And then what are the various duties of the priesthood, from deacon to teacher and so forth? And then duties of the members, the reason we hold meetings, sacrament, and then towards the end, we're to keep a membership record of those who are members of the church. We also find that on that very foundational day, April 6, 1830, that there will be our first baptisms into the church. So you'd say Oliver Cowdery and Joseph Smith were baptized down in the Susquehanna River. But you'd say, well, who's baptized on April 6, 1830? And Martin Harris, our only picture of him, when he's an older man, when he's 88 years old, Martin Harris is baptized on April 6, 1830. Over to the far side, you can see Joseph Smith's father, Joseph Smith Sr. He's baptized into the church. And then the one that looks probably pretty scary to any of us is Orrin Porter Rockwell.
You want him on your side.
Yeah, you want him on your side. Yeah, okay. Gunslinger by trade. And Orrin Porter Rockwell, a boyhood friend of the prophet Joseph. He, like Joseph, had a limp on the left side. You'd say for him, an unusual trait, his voice didn't change. So if you could get him mad, he can be an amazing soprano. You know, you two could probably do a duet, Clayton. You know, he could hit all the high notes for you. But for him, he decided using his guns was better than using his voice when he was upset. So you get three very different people. Joseph Smith Sr. will stay true to the faith all the days of his life. For Martin Harris, he's in, then he's out about 38 years. And Orrin Porter Rockwell, he's in, but you'd say he's in because he really loves Joseph and then Brigham, but attending church was not his favorite thing. So he's a really good bodyguard. That's the one you want. Yeah. But sitting and meeting and listening to one talk after another, you probably have a hard time finding him. Well, once the church is organized, although you have people talking about the church and believers sharing the gospel with friends, you'd say, who is our first official missionary? And it's Joseph's brother, Samuel Smith. And Samuel Smith, as he's officially then called on a mission, he is told to carry copies of the Book of Mormon and to sell them for $2 apiece. And for Samuel Smith, he heads out from Palmyra, New York, and he goes to a neighboring town of Mendon, New York. And there in Mendon, New York, we find that he's going to have a tough time trying to sell those books because you've got Martin Harris that's standing on the corners there on Main Street, especially where the four churches are located. And Martin Harris is willing to sell the books for $1.25. And you'd say, why is that? Well, he's trying to save his farm. And he's put up his farm as collateral to cover the cost of printing the books. And so you've got, at one point, you got Grandin selling for $1.75, Martin $1.25, and Samuel Smith trying to sell him for $2. So right away, you'd say our first missionary is definitely, you know, a long shot, right? Okay, mm-hmm. Well, as he heads out on this mission, he heads to Mendon, New York. He's discouraged. He's out about 3 days. He comes home, and that was considered an honorable mission. And he's frustrated because he's only able to give away two copies of the Book of Mormon. And you'd say eventually he goes back there. This time he takes as his companion, his mother. So I don't know if any of the missionaries back there would be hoping that their mom would accompany them on a mission.
Some, probably.
I know I wasn't. I don't know about you, Clayton, but, you know, you sure love them, but anxious to move along, right? And you'd say, well, was Samuel Smith a success on that mission? Obviously, he didn't think so. He wasn't able to sell any Book of Mormons, but he did give two copies away. And those copies eventually end up in the hands of Brigham Young and Heber C. Kimball. So I guess the message for all of us, you know, you just never know what good you do. And try and imagine, he thinks he hasn't been able to do what he's been asked to do to sell the Book of Mormons. But obviously his books get in the hands of men that will eventually be sustained as prophets, seers, and revelators. So I'm pretty impressed with Samuel Smith. He serves mission after mission, travels over 4,000 miles before his life is over, sharing the gospel along the way. So a really great man as our first missionary.
And he didn't end up even selling those two copies, right? He ended up giving them away.
Yeah.
And they weren't directly to either Brigham Young or Heber C. Kimball, right?
No, they actually went
like
to secondhand. A Methodist reverend, and then, you know, circumstance will lead along the way, a brother-in-law, and eventually Brigham, and Brigham shares it with his friend Heber, who is a potter by trade. And notice, Clayton, he's not smoking pot, so he's actually making pots. And, you know, boy, would I like to have one of the pots that he made. But, all right. Well, once you get Samuel Smith called, then you start seeing list after list of missionaries called. And you look at the 48 revelations that eventually come out of Kirtland. And eventually, as you read them, you say, so many of them say, so-and-so's called on a journey, which means they're called as missionaries. Now, most of the missionaries now called, where they'll be called to is 26 states in the United States. As you see this flag, that's what our flag looked like. The farthest western state is Missouri, so most of the missionaries will be in the east. So people joining the church at first are definitely northerners as opposed to those that lived in the south. As we look and we say, well, what about our first foreign missionaries? And for them, there are missionaries who are called to be missionaries to the Lamanites. You get Oliver Cowdery. We recognize him. He's been in the church a long time at this point, although the church is new. He was your scribe with Joseph. He received the Aaronic and the Melchizedek priesthood, also with Joseph. And then you'd say the middle pitcher is Parley P. Pratt of the missionaries to the Lamanites. He's your big baptizer. I don't know if his baptismal clothes ever got a chance to dry out. You know, he's your enthusiastic missionary in the water. You see Peter Whitmer Jr., scary look over there as they've tried to color up his picture. And for him, he's a tailor by trade. And as the missionaries move out to the borders of the Lamanites, which is the Indian Territory just beyond Independence, he stops along the way and he's getting a job as a tailor. Even as we go forward, we'll find he makes a suit for Lilburn W. Boggs, a man who becomes the governor of Missouri, and Alexander Doniphan, a very famous attorney. And then there's Ziba Peterson that we don't have a picture of. And Ziba kind of messes up along the way, you know, becomes interested in some of the women, especially once they hit Independence. So there's your missionaries. I think I can pick out something about all my companions through them. But Oliver, you know, the powerful testimony, the baptizer, the guy that might be out there selling blood would be this Peter Whitmer Jr. and then Ziba Peterson. Okay. All right. The missionaries head out. And as they head out, they're going about 1,600 miles. Notice you've got Fayette up in a corner. Recall that's where the Peter Whitmer farm is located, where the church is organized. As the missionaries head out, they literally talk to Native American tribes along the way that haven't been pushed out by the nation to the Indian Territory. But their greatest success will be in a small agrarian rural community called Kirtland. And from there, they will then work their way about another 800 miles or more to Independence. Now, in Kirtland, it becomes like the who's who in the Doctrine and Covenants of who's joining the church as these missionaries come through. You get Edward Partridge, who's a hatter by trade, you know, makes hats. You get Sidney Rigdon, who's a preacher there in Mentor, Ohio. You get Newell K. Whitney, a storekeeper that eventually becomes our bishop. So many of the famous names we know in church history will be baptized there in Kirtland, and they will baptize in the town of Kirtland, surrounding areas, 127 people. So when you say were the missionaries to the Lamanites a great success, I think so. But we don't know of any Native Americans that they did baptize.
But it's also, I was thinking it's kind of interesting that the Lord sends them basically straight to Independence.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, yeah, so they don't get really to be the first to step their feet onto what will be New Jerusalem, Zion for the saints. So a blessing for these missionaries when not expected, right?
Yeah.
Well, all right. The question is, well, how does the church grow? Notice we're taking it from April 6, 1830, when we're saying six official members of the church, and we take it to 1844, which is the martyrdom of the prophet Joseph and his brother Hiram. Okay, I actually tried to find every person that joined the church that met the prophet Joseph and pulled together about, oh, wow, I think I've got 48,000 pages in this project of the early membership. And, I'm always, what do we know about them? What else can we learn about them? Well, okay, not to bore everyone, but what I found in the growth of the church, so this would be the church during the 14 years that Joseph lives, right, after it's organized.
So you're talking about people who were members of the church that you...
Yeah, members of the church for a 14-year period. And what I found was there were more men in the church than women. Whereas if you look today, I'm sure it'd be reversed. But you'd say, why would there be more men? And the answer is Joseph's church is always pressing on the frontier. So notice it starts out in Western New York. The first part of the United States to open up beyond the kind of 13 colonies geographical area. And then the church pushes west to Ohio and then to Missouri and to Illinois. So we're always like on the edge of the frontier. And you'd say, who goes west first? It's always the man. And if he likes what he found in the West, then he returns back to his home. He gathers his wife and sweetheart, and Clayton sometimes are one and the same. So with that,
hopefully,
you get a Joseph's church is more men than women. And you'd say common surnames, they're coming from the East. You can imagine the most common surname is Smith, right? The most common male name is John, not John Doe, but John Smith in the church, and female names, Mary. And you look at them, you can't find a Juan or a Maria, Antoinette. you're looking at a pretty similar group. And you'd say average age, they're in their 20s. So it's a very young church.
Yeah.
And you'd say people like me, I'd be Mother Black. Probably at this point, Grandma Black, so you're saying Joseph's church is young. It's like our young adult wards are, getting together. That's a typical look of a church meeting during Joseph's time. Just showing another statistic, looking at John Smith, average age 23. If these people were to trace their ancestry, they're coming from the British Isles. You're not going to find people during Joseph's time, the 14 years. They're not coming from Spain. They're not coming up from Mexico. They're not from France. They're definitely British Isles. And I know mine were, a lot of them were from Wales, and makes them all short. like, come on, I needed those tall guys to come in the church. You'd say once they're in the church, you've got different patriarchs from Father Smith on, but the typical saint's going to get his patriarchal blessing from Hiram during those years.
I have an ancestor who got a patriarchal blessing from Hiram.
Oh, you do? Oh, that's great. So then you'd say more statistical kind of thing. If you were to look and to say you've got the second generation, you're going to name your children. You can find by the second generation, they're starting to give their children Book of Mormon names. Like, I know my father, middle name is Moroni. And you start to look, you see a lot of Almas. And you see even Rohanrai, Coriantumr, Calhoun. And so you get the second generation. You realize then that those that join the church, they're reading the Book of Mormon. They've got, Teancums coming in. You got some real serious heroes. Alma's a really strong name, Mormon. In fact, Martin Harris's brother Emer and his wife had what was believed to be the first child born to Latter-day Saints parents and they named their child Joseph Mormon Harris. So you get these second generations. You know, I've wondered if people, as they look back on our generations, the time in which they live, will they even wonder if we read the Bible, you know, as we come up with Stephanie, you know, da-da, da-da. And, you know, even Clayton, you know, I'm going, well, where does that one come from?
Yeah, where's Susan?
We know the heritage, racial background. There are a few Native Americans before Joseph dies that will join the church. There's a few African Americans who will join the church. But by far, it's this English-born and bred, pretty homogenous group. And you'd say predominant states in which the saints resided, oh, it's the East. Massachusetts, Connecticut, Vermont, they're all coming from that. New York, average age, we know. And then I was interested to find who is the longest living of anyone that I ever found. And her name was Mary Gardner. She actually knew the prophet Joseph when she was a young girl, and she didn't die until 1943. And you'd go, oh my gosh, that's amazing. She lives to be 107. And so although we could look, and for most that are generational Latter-day Saints and can say I'm a fifth, sixth, seventh, even eighth now generation, you'd say her family line would be able to say, well, I'm a second generation. And I know it's pretty same in my family line. The women, we just don't seem to die. Like, you know, we live on. And we used to have a joke in our family, if we're going to get my mom's inheritance, we're going to have to take out her heart and beat it, you know, because, you know, it's this long living. So although we could say we're generations away from the prophet Joseph, not really. In other words, we're closer than we think, depending on which ancestral line we come through. Well, all right, as we move along, we're going to find that Joseph will introduce early into the church through the Lord and by revelation that the saints need to gather. And today we gather in stake centers, we gather in ward houses, we're supposed to bloom where we're planted. But back then, when you joined the church, the missionaries would then talk about gathering, and to stay in the church, you'd have to gather to a central place. So the first gathering place where people will pick up and move to will be Kirtland, Ohio. And Joseph Smith and his wife Emma are the first to arrive in Kirtland, Ohio. Joseph will literally alight from his sleigh. He will see Newell K. Whitney, co-owner. As he sees him out there on the porch, he will go up to him and he will say, "Thou art the man." Now, they sold for years a t-shirt in Kirtland called "Thou Art the Man." And I think it would be appropriate for your daughters, Clayton, to buy those kind of t-shirts when they finally find the one they totally love. Thou art the man.
Thou art the man.
But when Joseph says to Newell K. Whitney, "Thou art the man," Newell says, "You know, sir, you have the better of me. I can't call you by name." And by this point, Newell has been baptized by the missionaries that were sent to the Lamanites. And when he says, "I can't call you by name," Joseph says, "I'm the prophet Joseph. You prayed me here. Now, what do you want of me?" And so Kirtland is our first gathering place. We have other gathering places along the way, but one of my favorites is a place called Nauvoo. And Nauvoo, you get them gathering not just from the 26 states as they're moving in, but you get them coming from the British Isles. And eventually, you're going to get some coming from France. In other words, the word is being passed. The messages are going around the world. Of all the gathering places that we've had in the church, none has been larger than the gathering to the Salt Lake Valley. And so we'd say that gathering, if you call yourself a pioneer, you're crossing the plains in 47, and you're still a pioneer until the railroads are tied together on May 10th, 1869. So from 47 to 69, you've got about 80,000 people are going to trek then from, starting in Nauvoo, others coming along through Iowa, Nebraska, and eventually to the Salt Lake Valley. Now, the concept of gathering will stay in effect until Heber J. Grant is president of the church. And in the 1920s, he's called to California, and many of the young men had gone there, including my dad. And, everyone thought he's coming down there to tell him to get back home. You know better. You're supposed to stay in the Intermountain West. Not supposed to be spreading out. We gather. We gather so we can build temples. And Heber J. Grant will say on that occasion that you can be in the world. In other words, you can actually stay living here in California, but don't be of the world. So since that time, people have been encouraged, if you live in Norway, you build up the church in Norway. You be in the world, just don't be of the world. And Clayton, if you live in Kansas City now, you're going to be in the world. Just don't join of the world in Brazil and Africa and wherever it is. And suddenly you start to see these gathering places becoming huge with the idea Spanish is now a dominant language in the church, as there have been such amazing success from Mexico on down through the Southern Hemisphere. Well, we live in a most unusual time, right?
We do.
We live in a time now where the work of the Lord is hastening forward. And you see these just handsome missionaries accepting calls to places they've never heard of. I know that when my son got a call to Fortaleza, Brazil, we had to get a map out because he wasn't sure where Brazil was. So it's like never dreamed of it, never hoped for it. You know, he was he liked ping pong, tennis. You know, he thought for sure he's going to Hong Kong. He's going to, do something. But, where they're just called all over the world. And
you're just so excited to... Sorry to interrupt. You're just so excited to go, right? And you basically commit beforehand. I don't care where I go. I don't care where you tell me to go. I'll go there.
Right.
If it's on the other side of the world, if it's the next state over.
Right. I'll go where you want me to go. And I know I had one son call to Boston, and he's like, all his friends were going to these exotic places around the world, and yet it was a defining time for him and the success, the happiness that he had. I mean, it's just like you're saying, I'll go where you want me to go, dear Lord. I'll be what you want me to be.
Yep.
So you get these great young men. And in addition to them, you also have these just beautiful young women that are also heading out. And, the elders, the sisters, you'd say, what do they all have in common with Samuel Smith? And I go, there's always this element of sacrifice. It's leaving mom and dad, leaving home. Oh, that's tough. Leaving your pets, maybe even tougher. if you got a car, a new bike, skis, how can you do this? And if you think you found your true love, a scholarship to college. And it's absolutely amazing what people will give up to be able to share the gospel and to tell the people to prepare that Christ is coming and this is the latter days, and share with them what can be a happy life for them.
You serve a mission as a youth, Susan?
No, I didn't, but I've
just
made
as an
up
adult.
For it, Clayton, since.
Yeah.
I've now served, I don't know, maybe 6 missions. Anyway,
yeah, you
go... Why would you do that? I go,
sick.
I've been a psychologist, and you go, I'm listening to all these people. Why would I do that? And I go, if it can help people to have a better life, you bet. And served a couple missions to Nauvoo, one to St. George, church office building. Kind of goes, I even went down to Chile. So there's always this element of sacrifice.
Yeah.
Well, as we go forward, We're going to find, look for the young elders if you haven't seen them. Look for the beautiful sisters. You recognize them. They wear badges. And stop them and say you'd like to hear what they have to say. There's senior missionaries that are out there on the trail, and you'll find them. They look happy. They have purpose. They know what they're doing. And you'd say, of all the missionaries that have ever served, I wanted to talk about this man, whose name is LeGrand Richards. President Gordon B. Hinckley said of LeGrand Richards, he said, "Few men in our generation have done more to advance the work of the Lord." And for him, he wrote a book called Marvelous Work and a Wonder. And missionaries years ago, and perhaps even still today, you know, we'll take that book on their mission and read it. He was always a missionary at heart. I had a chance to study his life. Part I liked was he said when he was a kid, he wanted to live good so that when he got older, if he ever came back to speak in his home ward, that there wouldn't be the old lady sitting in the back talking about, well, I knew him as a kid and he was pretty rotten. So he just, I don't know, he was just always a great person. I wanted to share an experience that I had with him. I'm a young faculty member, but mind you, I look the same. And anyway, I had a chance to give the opening prayer at a devotional that he gave at BYU in the Marriott Center. And because of doing the opening prayer, I was invited to attend a luncheon that was being held for him. And in the Wilkinson Center, which is our recreation center, you can get your hair cut, bowling alley, go shopping in the bookstore kind of thing. But there's also a room there that has a beautiful chandelier and this large table. And that's where the luncheon was held. And you have these cute BYU students that are serving you. And he's at one end of the table. And the president of the university at that time was Jeffrey R. Holland. And so at one point, as we're all sitting there, Jeffrey Holland yells down to him and he says, "Elder Richards, how are you doing?" And LeGrand answers back and he goes, "How dare you ask me that?" And suddenly we're all pretty interested in our salad. You'd be amazed how people are noticing their croutons. They had nicely cut onions and the tomatoes. And finally, LeGrand, he hits his glass and he stands up and he goes, "Everybody look at me. How am I doing?" He pulls up a few strands of hair off the top of his head and he says, "This is all that's left." He takes off his glasses and says, "I can't see any of you without the aid of these." He takes out his hearing aids and he goes, "I can't hear a word you say without these." He then takes out full plates of teeth and mumbles something like, you know, and he just kind of keeps going through his body. And when he sits down, boy, nobody's talking, not even Jeff, who has such a good personality. I mean, we're all just eating and everything goes real silent in the room. I mean, how do you respond to that? You know, the effects of aging. And then finally, this Elder Richard says, "Okay, Jeff, why don't you ask me, how are you doing, LeGrand?" And Elder Holland goes, "I don't want to." In other words, I already saw your reaction. He goes, come on, just ask me, "How are you doing, LeGrand?" And he goes, "Okay. How are you doing, LeGrand?" He hits his glass again. He stands up and he goes, "You know," he said, "I've been through the refiner's fire. I've been through the fuller's soap. I have borne my testimony in this land and this land and this land. I've carried the Book of Mormon." I mean, you know, he just goes off on this personal sacrifice. And he goes, "You know, I've never been better than I am today." And he said, "Soon I will die, and I will be with my wife who I loved, and we will be young again." And he said, "And I will be with my Savior, and I can hardly wait." So when I think of this man, as Gordon B. Hinckley says, "Few men in our generation have done more to advance the work of the Lord than the Grand Richards. I think, boy, what a reception was waiting for him and the blessings that will come his way from his service. So I guess tonight, Clayton, for any of our listening audience that have passed by these really nice-looking young men, young women, older couples wearing badges that are representatives of the Lord Jesus Christ, instead of just driving past as if you didn't notice them, you saw them, stop them and ask, so tell me about the Book of Mormon. Tell me about Joseph Smith. You know, tell me about Christ. What can you tell me that my life could be better and happier? And tell me how I could be sealed together with my family forever. And anyway, sure glad the church was organized.
Me too. Can't imagine, cannot imagine my life without it. It's so,
no, it just wouldn't have
just
been
makes,
great.
Makes life so meaningful and happy and, you know, a lot of work maybe sometimes, but
yeah, lots
it's very
of work.
Fun, very fun and fulfilling. And my daughter's in Arizona right now, being one of those lovely young ladies. She is just so happy.
Oh, that's so, so great.
So stinking happy and doing a great job. But they would love to talk to you if you, yeah, if you have any, just make up a question if you don't have any. They would love to talk to you. All right, well, this last verse of this song makes me think a lot of missionary work. The guy who wrote it, like I said, from Ireland, he was a missionary. He went back to Ireland, I think, multiple times. Here we go, verse 4. Israel, Israel, canst thou linger still in error's gloomy ways? Mark how judgment's pointing finger justifies no vain delays. Come to Zion, Zion's walls shall ring with praise. Come to Zion, Zion's walls shall ring with praise.
Perfect.
Come on to Zion, guys. If you're not here already, come on. It's the place to be. All right. Thank you, Susan.
Thanks, Clayton.
We will move on to our next one next time.
Sounds great.
Okay. Have a good one.